Father John A. Hardin is a well-known author, lecturer, and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises, and is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. The following conference is a series of lectures given by Father Hardin on Oriental religions. Father has for many years studied and taught about these divergent beliefs of the peoples of the world. He is the author of the book Religions of the World. Father Hardin first engaged in the teaching of these religions to Jesuit scholastics to prepare them for missionary work in the East. Father is a well-known authority in this field and brings out the truth and error in each belief. In the following conference, Father Hardin speaks on the subject, Basic Principles of Islam. Father Hardin.
First of all, we enter into a different climate as we start with Islam, for the simple reason that Islam is, though an Oriental religion, a religion which is monotheistic, a religion which is derived from Judaism, not unlike Christianity, a religion that was deeply influenced by Christian thought. In fact, the Quran is unintelligible without Christianity. A religion that has a high respect for Christ and Mary, and a religion again which for a long time was the greatest challenge to the Christian world. Clearly we are in a different atmosphere. Unfortunately for most Christians, Mohammedanism, which is really a misnomer, it should be called Islam, is mainly the religion we know about from the Crusades, having studied that, or in modern times, the dominant religion in Africa, and the main single reason for African nationalism. The proliferation of countries in Africa would be unintelligible except for the strong aggressive drive of Islam. Mohammedanism has been called, and correctly, the most powerful force among the living religions outside of Christianity, and to many observers, including this one, it is the greatest competitor of Christianity for the spiritual domination of the world. And the only trouble, for example, for the white people, in looking upon what they see happening all around us now, in the rise of what they call black power, the only mistake we can make is to suppose it's just, again, some kind of flare-up, and that black Muslimism or the relationship between the colored people in the States and their ethnic counterparts in Africa is just something which has grown up and has no particular significance. It's a grave mistake. There's a close relationship. In fact, in largest measure, and one of the ideas or ideals that Islam is trying to develop is to identify the African people with Islam. And of course, they've got numbers on their side. The correct name, as we mentioned before, is Islam, which Muhammad himself adopted. It was his term as a description of the faith that he proclaimed. Grammatically, the word Islam, which is Arabic, is the infinitive of a verb which means to resign oneself, to submit, or most accurately, to surrender. By implication, oneself or one's person to God. A good paraphrastic translation of the Arabic Islam would be sacrifice. Those who profess it are called Muslims, of which the Western form is Muslims, meaning believers. So a Muslim is a believer. and Islam is sacrifice. And consequently, believers who offer themselves, surrender themselves to God as distinct from the kafirs, as the object opposite of Muslims, the rejectors of the divine message of salvation. Muslims themselves dislike the word Mohammedans or Mohammedanism because it suggests, but of course they absolutely reject, the worship of Muhammad, and by implication correlating that with the worship of Christ, which of course is of the essence of Christianity. There is no intelligibility of Islam without an understanding of Muhammad, the founder. Much more than Buddha, who after all lived much further back. More so also because he wrote the Quran, that is, Muhammad wrote the Quran, which is the scriptures, more so than anything that Buddha ever purportedly wrote. The main source of material, therefore, for the understanding of Islam is the Quran, and behind the Quran stands Muhammad. The main source of our knowledge of Muhammad, of his life and teachings, is the Quran itself and early Arabic lives. And they've got to be pretty early, because there has since been an accumulation of legend that you simply cannot historically subscribe to without a great deal of reservation. We know he was born at Mecca, which is in Arabia, and which at that time was a mixture, a cosmopolitan city, a mixture of Christians and Jews, and of course a lot of Arabic polytheists. Those three types of people, by the way, have simply got to be known as the background, the drop backdrop, as it were, of Islam, because he borrowed heavily from the Jews and the Christians. He reacted strongly, first against the Arabic polytheists, and then, by the end of the Quran, against everybody, Jews and Christians, and of course polytheists, to develop his own religion. Mecca was a commercial city and was also a center of these polytheists, or whatever we wish to call them, who were also animists, people, in other words, who would worship the forces of nature, or sometimes even less than forces of nature, as somehow believing them to be animated by powers which they could then invoke. Up to 35 years old, he was an ordinary tradesman. He traveled a good deal, and even as a boy, he would be in the caravan between Mecca and distant places. He became involved in the business of transporting material from Mecca back and forth, and indeed he later on fell in love with a woman, Khadijah, a widow who was the owner of one of these trade companies in whose caravan he worked, and he married his employer and found it much to his advantage. But being a commercial city, you would expect it, as most large polyglot cities are, a city of moral and social decadence. And he reacted against it. And this, in a way, is the beginning of Islam. The reaction of this young man, who was a spiritual-minded person, against what he saw all around him. He saw polytheists whom he disliked. He saw Christians and Jews, who were often not so faithful to their teaching. And yet he found in Judaism, as far as we can tell, the foundation of his own religion. Had there been no Judaism, there would have been no Islam. The best we can say was that before he became what he became, namely a Muslim, Muhammad was a proselyte Jew. In other words, he had not been a Jew by birth, but one who had read deeply in the Old Testament, loved it, patterned his life on it, and found there especially that one unique deity whom he could pray to, invoke, and depend upon. His marriage to the widow Khadijah changed his life. Above all, it gave him more time for leisure. And she seems to have encouraged it. She was a businesswoman, and she was quite happy to have a meditative husband. She, it seems, for years to come, earned more than their daily bread. So he did the praying and the meditating. She did the working and the earning. Which, by the way, suggests something also to us. How to start a new religion. It was during these periodic prayers that he had, as he believed, visions, and specifically visions in a cave to which he had betaken himself to get away from the noise. He felt commissioned on the basis of these visions to teach what he had already learned from the Old Testament, one absolute Lord. If you have your books and return to Surah 96, Surah 96, I think the page is 445, correct? Let's just look at the introduction. Verses 1 to 5 are the words which the prophet received in the vision at Hira, or Jaira, therefore the first of the Quran to be revealed. So the genesis of the Quran, I have it, sister, 445. Page 445 in the book. Surah 96. Thank you, sister. It is the first of the Quran to be revealed, and therefore this is the genesis. This is, you might say, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Let's read. It's a very short surah. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. As you know, this is a constant recurring introductory phrase in the Quran and Muhammad's own. Read. Now, this is a command. In the name of thy Lord who created. Notice, very much as Genesis. Created man from a clot. Sounds familiar. Read, and thy Lord is the most bounteous, who teacheth by the pen, and of course at this point he already recognizes himself as a prophet, and what he wrote therefore is to be read. Teacheth man that which he knew not, therefore a revelation. Nay, but verily man is rebellious. He needs therefore to be taught. That he thinketh himself independent. The first verses of the Quran, completely different language, where the heart of both Hinduism and Buddhism, the Atman, the self, independence, my gosh, the word independent is too weak to express what they mean. He is, in a way, all there is, certainly in monistic Hinduism. Atman is Brahman, and here, who thinks himself independent. Lo, unto thy Lord is the return. Now that word return is profound. In other words, that where a man has come from God, in other words, ontologically man came from God. Psychologically, his tendency is to remain wrapped up in himself. And there are two big religions, the two largest of human history and the most ancient, that do just that. They wrap man up in himself. When therefore Muhammad bids man to return to his Lord, it means to return in spirit where he came from in being. And that's a good definition of religion. To return in spirit where man came from in being. Hast thou seen him who dissuadeth a slave when he prayeth? Hast thou seen if he relieth on the guidance of Allah or enjoineth piety? Hast thou seen if he denieth Allah's guidance and is froward? Is he then unaware that Allah seeth? Notice what he's complaining about? The lack of religion. In fact, by comparison with the first two we have seen, this is religion. Nay, if he cease not, we will seize him by the forelock, the lying, sinful forelock. Then let him call upon his henchmen. We will call upon the guards of hell. Obey not thou him, but prostrate thyself and draw near unto Allah. Don't be misled by the man who has abandoned Allah. This is the beginning, and in 19 verses is the synthesis of Islam. From the very beginning, therefore, of his life, that is, as a visionary now, he felt commissioned to teach one absolute Lord, and the visions, as I have in your notes, lasted, we believe, for about 12 years. However, with slight success of evangelizing others, which is not surprising. In other words, he had the vision, others didn't. He was preaching what they didn't like. Notably, and this is well to know, he was a pragmatist. If Buddha was, so was Muhammad, a pragmatist. He was by no means a metaphysician. He was not, he was not a philosopher. He was a prophet. He claimed he saw, and he told people, you believe or else. And he didn't allow himself to be questioned why. At 52, now this gives us about 17 or so years of adjustment and so on. By 52, and this is pretty fairly correct chronology, he had to run for his life. Where? To Medina. And therefore, the famous flight from Mecca to Medina. It even sounds good. The date we have of the 622 AD in our chronology. That's the famous Hajira. Variously spelled, the one I have used is H-E-G-I-R-A, which means flight. And therefore, the Muslims date, even as we date our calendar, Anno Domini, the year of the Lord, 1967, which is a few years off, but by and large it's 1967, dating from the birth of Christ. So they date in Latin chronology the Anno Hegirae, A-H. And whenever they write in letters that our own alphabet, they would use the word, whatever the date happens to be, A-H. And so what you do, and you can figure out immediately, subtract 622 from 1967, and you get what? 1345, right? So this is 1345 A-H. The 1345th year from the flight of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. He set up at Medina a theocracy, though of course a very Mohammedan theocracy. In other words, it was a theocracy which was screened, of course, or interpreted by his own understanding. He was there from, as far as we can tell, from about 52 to 60. And he set down six rules, which are pretty important. Because while there is infinitely more to Islam than these six rules, they represent, as far as we can tell, the beginnings of Islam and fundamentally what he wanted his followers to do and what they are bidden to do ever since. The first, and understandably the first, was only one God was to be worshipped, Allah. Allah is the Arabic combination of two words, Al, which is the definite article, and God, Ilah, Al-Ilah, which means the God, and there is only one such. One God that was to be worshipped, and that is a condition of salvation. Secondly, and by the way, you will notice each one of these is something which had not been done before. That's why he made a law or a rule. Secondly, no stealing. And a man who was in business, he knew how commonplace that was. Secondly, no adultery. Now, as we'll see when we handle this, he, of course, later on had his own interpretation of what adultery means, but that's part of Islam. Fundamentally, and this is well to know, Islam is based on the strictest laws of justice. Let's just flip back for a moment. One God is to be worshipped. You see how that reflects the Decalogue, doesn't it? In other words, I am the Lord thy God. For us, in our Decalogue, it has three mandates. But then God is to be worshipped, and the religion that anyone practices, which is authentically religion, is paying God his due. In fact, that's my definition of religion. Paying God his due. In other words, it is a form of justice, which always implies two entities, two beings. Normally, as we conceive justice, it's between two human beings. Somebody has something which I don't take away, so that's justice. Somebody does some work for me, and I'm supposed to pay them a wage. That's justice. God created me. He sustains me. Well, the least he demands is that I acknowledge his existence. That's the least respect I can pay to the one who brought me into being. And that I would periodically think of him. And periodically ask him for the things that I need. Because he keeps reminding me, three times a day at least, how much I need him. And if I need him in body, if I depend on things outside of me, talk about proofs of contingency. And by the way, I'm here getting into what happens, by the way, as I'm sure you know in your own teaching, once you get into something and if you prepare yourself, your mind picks up all kinds of ideas from the thing that you're talking about. This is the language of Muhammad proving to his followers that they depend on God, that the one thing that man discovers from the moment he comes into existence is his utter insufficiency, inadequacy. He's got to keep putting things into himself to sustain his life. He must fill one aperture of his body with things from the outside in order to keep his own body alive. At any rate, the justice, therefore, to God. Secondly, justice to others in there being no stealing, not taking away what they have, what they own. And then no adultery. For Muhammad, that is basically a law of justice. Now, let's anticipate, because we will not be able to say all we would like to say about Muslim polygamy. The most interesting, and by the way, for us, a very relevant subject. Because ours is a polygamous society. No question about it. America is polygamous. And as I tell my students, students, and I am now telling you, I almost have to remind myself that you are students, that all cultures are naturally polygamous. Man is naturally polygamous. And the best that any other religion could ever dare to do, including the Jewish, was to legalize polygamy. Never dreamt of forbidding it. Only God would dare command that and then have the incredible hope of thinking that anybody would practice it. So adultery for him was that somebody else has a woman. By the way, my gosh, there's no question of adultery if she doesn't belong to anybody. And by the way, there's a masculine preoccupation which I ask you to watch for in reading the Quran. You wonder where the women come in. So it's mainly that a man should not take another woman, another man's wife. On the other hand, and this is already, I'm interpreting and anticipating, that as long as she is available, he may have her. It's not adultery because nobody injustice is being done. She's willing. There's no man that claims her. And if he doesn't care, he gives her up. Well, if two men can get satisfaction out of one woman, why not? That's efficiency. So adultery, therefore, is based on a very crude type of justice. Fourth, no killing of children, especially the unborn. Infanticide and abortion were rife in pre-Islamic Arabia. Oh, how I would want to shout from the housetops for people to know what's happening in our Western society. But where do you go? Whom do you speak to? Well, that's what I'm trying to do to you, to tell you, to share with you, and hope that you will read and deepen your understanding of other people's historic culture in this case. You see what I am saying. Fifthly, no slander of others. No slander of others. Quite obviously, because there was an awful lot of slander going around. Now, whether it is strictly theological definition of slander here, what he meant was telling lies about other people. So I think we distinguish, don't we, between calumny and slander. Well, the terminology slander is found in English commentaries, and I use it. What it means is that a person does not talk about others, in other words, destroy their character in order to achieve his own ends. And finally, and of course, he wouldn't have been intelligent if he hadn't said this, the sixth rule was obedience to Muhammad in all that was revealed to him. So God in Rule 1 and Muhammad in Rule 6. And between them, you have a lot. He early built a mosque. We have no evidence of any large building of mosques in Muhammad's own lifetime. He did, however, have one built for daily prayers and Friday devotions. Friday, as you know, is a sacred day among the Muslims, even as Saturday is for the Jews and Seventh-day Adventists, and of course Sunday for Christians. It is well to know, and this needs exploration, by the way, among the authors who write about Mohammedanism, Gibbs, G-I-B-B-S, is, I consider, the most informative and the most up-to-date, and he has a nice synthetic touch. In a single book, he can crowd a great deal. I think he is the outstanding Western scholar of Islam. The early life of Muhammad, this is after he had finished his business, that is, his trade, commissioned to root out polytheism, to cut down on the immorality. And by the way, if people find fault with Quranic morality, talking to Muslims, they're shocked that you're being surprised. They ask you, do you know the kind of Arabia that Muhammad was born into? Well, most people say no. Well, he improved things immensely, and he did. And let it be also said, he sent from the beginning with a genius, because he was a genius, with a genius that only a man of his ardent nature could recognize, that there is no improvement of morality without solid, sound religious principles, indeed monotheism. I hope this is a new insight, because we need it. He had all sorts of military battles and successes at various places. There are two especially, one called Badir, B-A-D-I-R, and another called the Battle of the Ditch, kind of trench warfare centuries before the First World War, in which he had astounding success, overcame those who opposed him, because by this time he was literally setting himself up as the leader of Arabia, or of the Arabs who wanted to join him. He was a prophet, indeed simultaneously, prophet, priest, and king. And he knew his Old Testament well. He knew his messianic prophecies well. I'm anticipating. He was the great Messiah to now supplant, and the last of them following the first Messiah, who was Christ. Pardon me, I should say three, because he believed there were three great prophets chosen by Yahweh: Moses, Christ, and Muhammad. At any rate, he fought for what he believed to be the truth, and at first he was going to march on Jerusalem, and Islam would have changed completely had he done so. In other words, by this time he sensed, and he was beginning to realize it, and the Quranic surahs reveal this, that what he began with a Jewish background, not a Jewish ancestry, but Jewish theological background, he hoped, and understandably, he hoped that the Jews would buy what he was saying. And he went back to the Old Testament text and said, look, Isaiah and the others foretold me. Don't you want a deliverer? Don't you think that you need me? Well, they didn't like it. And as a consequence, and this did not last too long, because Muhammad did not live too long after he started this, shall we call it, his public life. But during the rather short time that he preached and propagated his doctrine, he found the Jews less and less sympathetic to his aims, and therefore the later surahs, which by the way are not, unfortunately, later in the Quran, there's no way of telling except by reading each surah in its introduction to know when it was written. In other words, this is not from the beginning to the end chronologically. But the later surahs show a violent opposition to, well, first of all, there had always been opposition to the polytheists. That's why there was an Islam. There was a growing opposition to Jews and Christians. To Christians second, to Jews last. They were the last ones for whom he held out hope. In a way, as Paul held out hope for the Jews in his day. And finally, when neither the Arab animists and polytheists, nor the Christians, nor even the Jews accepted him, there was nothing to do, he felt, but now to fight them, and he did.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.